One and a half year approximately ago, some colleagues of mine at SUSE and I had a lot of fun sending MIDI data through the ALSA MIDI sequencer, so from external devices like MIDI master keyboards, from applications like MIDI sequencers, we sent it to a wavetable synthesizer of the Sound Blaster Live and to other application software synthesizers. And so we had a lot of fun doing this sending and connecting. And then, of course, the question arose whether this would be possible to do also with audio data. And, well, the answer is Jack.
Wait, okay. Patience is a virtue. As everybody who's waiting for Arda should know. I was trying to think up some joke to start with that would end with the line, "You don't know Jack," but it's probably a bit cross-cultural. So, the Jack Audio Connection Kit. I think most people in the room probably know what Jack is, but in the talk I'm going to try to cover a little bit of the history of where Jack's come from, other approaches to what it tries to do, the basic problems it's trying to solve, the internal design of it, what it's like using Jack, and a few observations on thoughts on how it could be improved. Back in May 2001, the Linux Audio Developers Mailing List started talking about the need to try to exchange audio data between applications, and not just exchange any old data, but be able to exchange large quantities of data with very low latency, and very importantly, to have the exchange be sample synchronized. We'll talk a little bit more about what that means as we go through the talk. The canonical scenario where this becomes important is if you have a multi-track editor or sequencer, you have a modular software synthesizer, you have a drum machine, you have a MIDI pattern sequencer, and you've been happily using each one of them, but now you'd actually like to use them so they work in combination. You'd like to use the multi-track editor to record the drum machine and the synthesizer. Maybe you'd like to feed data from the editor through the synthesizer to process it, whatever. So how do you do that? Well, the answer is that you can't. It's really that simple. At least you can't do it with any level of reliability. Now, another motivation that has grown really since we started working on Jack is that there are also quite a lot of LadSpar plugins in general, that require complex and quite dedicated graphical user interfaces. And LadSpar does not really support this. One recent example is Superlooper from Jesse Chapel, which is an implementation of something a bit like, I can't remember what it's a model of. It's a delay loop system. Or Hermes that Steve wrote quite a while ago. With both of them, they need GUIs that are really, it's a bit unrealistic to expect a host to build a generic user interface for them and have it work. So much for my careful sizing of these slides to fit on a screen, huh? So, obviously Windows and Mac OS users have faced just the same issues. They have the same applications and they'd like to do the same thing. So, it seems like it would be reasonable to ask, well, so what do these guys do? The answer is that, for the most part, on Windows and Mac OS, you have people writing monolithic host applications. They develop plugin APIs, and other people come along and they write plugins that do interesting and cool things. Those plugins can be anything from something as simple as delay line all the way up to a fully-fledged disk sampler. But the key thing is that in every case, they're a shared object that gets loaded into the host application and executes in the context of the host. and there are some problems with that, as we'll see. Now, two other examples of what looks like a different approach from the proprietary world would be rewire and direct connect. These were specifically invented to connect apparently independent applications and let them share audio data. But although that's what they appear to do, that's not really what they do in practice. They're really just a higher level plugin API. You still need to have a shared object that gets loaded into the host. It runs in the context of the host. So, in general, the answer in the Windows and Mac OS worlds to this has been plugins of one sort or another. In the Unix world, we've had a variety of different sound servers, most of which have used what generally gets termed the push model, which means that the application that is using the server gets to write audio data whenever it feels like it and writes as much as it feels like. It could generate very small amounts of data at a time or very large amounts of data. Examples of this, you know, ESD, RHD, NAS, MAS, there are a few others. However, most of them don't provide inter-application routing, RHD being a notable exception. All of them probably could provide inter-application routing if they wanted to. But they do have the problem that the push model doesn't maintain synchronous operation of all applications. And what we mean by this is that one application is generating audio for time N, another one is generating it for some other time. It actually could be exactly the same time plus a little bit. It could be a little bit before. Who knows? They're not generating audio that corresponds to the same time that we'll experience when we actually hear it. And this causes a number of problems, some of which I just decided to not go into at this point, but one of them that's worth mentioning is that any operating system will have difficulty scheduling these applications correctly. Imagine you have one app that writes very short blocks, another one that writes very large blocks. The audio interface is still ticking along in the meantime. We really don't want to slow everything down for this guy that is going to compute a half a second's worth of audio. But the OS doesn't know anything about this. And as a result of not knowing these things, and they really shouldn't know them, we have a very hard time getting this to work. Now, it does work for applications like MP3 players, system messages, and so forth, that are quite happy to use lots and lots of buffering. As we'll see later on, you know, buffering will help with all of this kind of stuff, but it introduces latency. And as a result, it tends to be not very acceptable for what we parenthetically call pro audio. So let's try to be a little bit more specific about what the design goals of Jack should be. It should allow streaming of low latency, high bandwidth data between independent applications. We'd like it to support any type of streaming data. At the moment, it only supports audio. In any particular Jack setup, there's one server and one or more Jack plugins, also called clients. You can run multiple setups, but they do not talk to each other. Jack is not interested in that type of scenario. Applications connected by Jack can have their own graphical user interfaces. Jack has nothing to say about the graphical user interface part of your application. It should provide full sample accurate synchronization. That is, that all clients should run in totally synchronously. Any time that one application computes audio that corresponds to a certain point in time, immediately before or immediately afterwards, every other client will compute the equivalent piece of audio for the exact same time. This is very different than a situation where you have, you're playing an MP3 file and you want to have a system beep come up, and you also have an incoming voicemail message from somebody. And there's no importance attached to whether these sample streams stay in sync with each other. It just doesn't matter. All you care about in that case is that you can hear them all at the same time. What we care about here is that every single client must be executing in exact lockstep. To represent audio, Jack will use a highly normalized data type, which is a 32-bit IEEE floating point value normalized to -1 to +1. And only non-interleaved audio streams will be supported. That means all of the sample streams are mono. I should have done graphic files instead of the web. Part two of the design goals, any JAT client can consume or produce multiple data streams. The JAT API is specified in ANSI C, which means in theory that you could wrap it with other languages very easily. It should be possible to connect already running applications. I don't think that we do that. And it should be possible to add or remove JAT clients while the server's running, fairly obviously, I believe. Now let's do a little quick overview of what's actually going on with audio interface stuff. We don't have to have a pointer, do we, of any kind? Do we have a pointer at all? I'll use a pen on my arm. It's actually more readable up here than it is on the screen. So down here we have, below this line, we basically have a hardware level that's an audio interface. And it has an input connector and an output connector. And data comes in on the input connector and ends up in a buffer. And it comes out of a buffer and goes out the output connector. Every so often, the audio interface interrupts the operating system. Well, it interrupts the CPU, which then wakes up the operating system. And at some point soon after the interrupt arrives, the device driver gets control and has to do something. One thing it might do is wake up applications that are sleeping. That is, they're in poll or select. They could also be in read or write, actually, but it's going to wake it up. In terms of the data flow above that, we have application software, which could either use the read or write system calls in some way to deliver data to the device driver. And the device driver will then dump them into the correct buffers. Or user space could be using Mmap, in which case it has direct access to these buffers and is able to write data directly into them, possibly using memcopy or some other direct memory access operation. So this is the basic thing that's going on anytime you're running an audio application. And it's my fervent religious faith that programming APIs should reflect this reality at some level. And I think that trying to move the abstractions too far away from this can lead to problems. But that is a matter of religious faith. So now let's talk about latency. What do we mean by latency? All we really mean is there's a delay between an action and its effect. You press a key and you hear a note. I didn't perceive any latency. You drag a mouse moving some knob on the screen or a fader, and the volume changes. The latency is a really central issue when using general purpose CPUs for audio work, because unlike some DSP chips, we really cannot do per sample processing. The architecture of the chip, the way we use things, it's not totally impossible, but with the architectures that most of us are working on, it just doesn't work. You have to take in audio in chunks, process it in chunks, and hand it back out in chunks. The chunks can be big or small, but they're chunks. They're not samples. And as a result, the size of those blocks means that however we slice it or dice it, there is a delay introduced at the very minimum by just that block-natured processing. Anything else we do above that makes things even worse. When the latency or the delay between action and effect gets above about 3 milliseconds, you start to make it hard for musicians and audio engineers to do their work. We don't have to get too concerned about this because, you know, 3 milliseconds is about the same delay you get standing about as far away from these loudspeakers as I am, which most people wouldn't think twice about. But obviously it can get worse than 3 milliseconds, and also there are situations where you're doing headphone monitoring or you're mixing with near-field monitors and they're very close to you, where sometimes it's just really critical. And obviously the classic examples are playing drums on a MIDI keyboard or a MIDI controller and having you hit the thing and then really perceiving a delay before you hear the sound. That's really bad. Now, we have three different kinds of input latency, really. We have input latency, which I'm going to define as the amount of time it takes us to be able to respond to an input signal. What's going on? Well, the data arrives at the audio interface. It gets buffered until the next interrupt. The interrupt happens, and now the CPU can access it. And at that point, that's the earliest we can possibly see the data that we get from the audio interface. The output side of things is much the same. The application has data ready to be delivered to the audio interface. The driver or something buffers it, or we block until the next interrupt. The interrupt comes along. Now it's time for us to hand it off. So we're all set. But there's a slight difference with output latency, which was on the previous slide, and I missed it because I didn't scroll down far enough. Other data may already be queued on the audio interface hardware itself. So just because we've delivered it to the audio interface doesn't mean we get to hear it right away. Now, the shortest latency configuration that you can get is going to be where you have two interrupts per hardware buffer. That is, you divide the buffer in two and you get an interrupt every time you cross from one half to the other. And what's going on is the hardware is working on one half. It's either playing from it or writing data into it. And then meanwhile, the software is working on the other half. The interrupt comes along, you switch around. This is just a variation on double buffering, which is very common in graphical programming. And in fact, this is the design that ASIO enforces. There's nothing but two interrupts per hardware buffer. ALSA, by contrast, allows multiple interrupts per buffer, not just two. So in summary, total output latency is equivalent to the whole buffer size. I could have spent a lot longer doing a slide to do all this, but most of you are familiar with this on some level. Input latency is equivalent to the interrupt interval. Through latency, that is how long it will take us if we get an audio signal coming in and we want to send it back out. The through latency is the same as the output latency. And also, these output latency numbers are worst case. There are some of the samples you write will actually have better latency than this. This is the worst case. Put in a different way, we can react to an input signal within one interrupt, and we can deliver audio within two. I'm going on about all this because latency is a fairly important part of Jack's design, which we'll see soon. I should have downloaded Mozilla. The problem with X-Window, so now we're just switching tracks to talk about another angle of where Jack comes from. We mentioned earlier on that, I'm mentioning now, X-Window is a low-level drawing abstraction. It's not a GUI toolkit, even though lots of people seem to get confused about that. Other software layers called toolkits make it easier to actually write software. There are a few people who write software just using Xlib, but they must be strange. It's not a pleasant experience. It's a good learning experience, but not a pleasant experience. So we have these toolkits, GTK, QT, FLTK, whatever. And they make it easier because they give us faders and buttons and text areas and all the stuff that we like to program with. The problem is it's extremely difficult to use two toolkits in the same process. And for most people, that isn't a problem. Most people write one program and they pick a toolkit and they write their software and it does what it needs to do. The problem that we face here is that most interesting plugins, I meant to actually say in here to not insult Steve too much, that many interesting plugins, one of the most interesting plugins, many interesting plugins, maybe I should say many interesting instruments or many interesting musical devices or something, because I think Steve's open that he writes plugins at a lower level than that for the most part. Many interesting plugins tend to be tightly coupled UI and DSP code. They have a user interface that has been custom designed to somehow give you a very hopefully efficient and intuitive way of controlling whatever it is that the DSP code does. So if that's true, then that means people are going to want to write these nicely designed, specifically designed GUIs for their DSP code, which means they're going to have chosen to use a particular toolkit to do that. But if the plugin uses toolkit A and the host uses toolkit B, it doesn't work. And this is a big problem, because either we tell people you can only use toolkit B, or it just doesn't work. And neither of those are acceptable. So one of the critical aspects of Jack's design has been all along, really, that it has to be possible to run plugins in another process. As well as being a desirable thing for this reason, it has some benefits in that it isolates the host from plugin errors, it avoids the requirement for IPC between the UI and the DSP code, and you, the developers, can choose whichever GUI toolkit you want. Problem is, if we run it in another process, this means we have to deal with the dreaded context switch. So what's a context switch? Well, very simply, we just save all the register values for the current process, then we restore all the register values for the next process we want to switch to, and then we keep going, and we're in the new process. However, on a machine with virtual memory, you have two programs running. They might both have pointers within them that point to the same address, but that doesn't actually mean it's intended to point to the same piece of memory. And so on systems with virtual memory, which is basically any machine that we use that wasn't built by Seymour Cray, such systems will map the virtual memory addresses that your program uses to physical memory. And that mapping changes when we switch from one process to another. There's some hardware to do this on Intel systems called a translation look-aside buffer. I think it has the same name on other systems too. But what's very important here is that when we switch from one process to the other, we have to invalidate everything in this buffer that's used to do this mapping. We also have to invalidate some or all of the cache. So the cost of a context switch is not just the register save and restore. There's also the impact of having to invalidate these two memory access mechanisms. Now, the register save and restore part tends to be linear with CPU speed. The faster the CPU, the faster the register save restore things happen. It's just a bunch of instructions. But the cache and TLB effects are different. They depend on a lot of different factors, which we don't have any control over. And to give you an idea of the numbers we're talking about, on most modern processes, you're looking at, on Linux at least, 10 to 50 microseconds to switch processes. However, those cache and TLB effects can double or quadruple that cost. Now, one of the most common things that affects the cost of the context switch is what's the process set working size? And in fact, all that matters here really is, to put it slightly more simply, how much memory does each program touch in between context switches? If it touches a lot of memory, you'll invalidate a lot of cache, and the cache needs to be refilled. Very expensive. If it touches hardly any memory, then there's almost no cache effect at all. Now, to put that 10 to 50 microseconds in context, if we're working down at the lowest latencies that many current PCI interfaces can support, 64 frames per interrupt, we have about 1,333 microseconds to do everything. So 10 to 50 microseconds is not a lot, but if we had 10 clients, that's 100 to 500 microseconds, nearly 50% of the total time we have available to do everything we need to do. The net result of all this stuff, all these computations, is that context switches are not so expensive that we can't use them, because we can. But they're not so cheap that we can ignore it. So, Jack represents, in some sense, a new design, in the sense that although we're going to run internal clients just like all the existing shared object APIs do, just like LadSpar does, just like VST does, just like Rewire does, we also want to be able to run external clients in other processes. How are we going to do that? Well, we need a way to share and move data efficiently, preferably zero copy, and we have to be able to communicate with them efficiently. And the solutions that we have chosen for now are shared memory, which is a zero copy method of exchanging data, and FIFOs for the communication part. I think early on in the implementation of Jack, I did try using signals, which seemed like they would be sort of custom made for this, but they're actually way slow, incredibly slow. So let's try to put it all together. Can we get this all on the screen? Oh, I guess we get the picture on the screen. So this is what's happening in a... Actually, there's lots of clients in this picture. I don't think that I or anybody else has ever tried to... Thank you. I don't think I or anybody else has ever tried to run anything as much as this. But right down the bottom down here, we have our famous, fabulous interrupt from the audio interface that comes up and wakes up what we call the driver part of Jack, which is sitting in a loop waiting for something. It's waiting for the interrupt. And once it gets it, it calls the process function in the engine. The engine looks at all the clients that it has that it needs to run, and it calls their process function in turn, which means that we call this guy, who's an internal client, that means it's a shared object. We loaded it into JackD, and it's running in process context. He then calls this guy, who calls this guy. Actually, you know what? I do this diagram wrong, but it'll work. In fact, what happens here is because these are internal, the engine calls this guy, and this guy. And then we pass off control to our first external client. This is a different process. This transition involves a context switch. We do another context switch, another context switch, another context switch, and then we come back into JackD, run a bunch of other internal clients, we're all done, and we go back to the driver and go to sleep again. It's the eternally moving slide projector. Somebody hold that thing down. So what's going on inside an external client? This solid box around the outside is sort of the delimiter of the process. And from our perspective, we're interested in just a few things. The stuff I'm going to talk about in a minute, we have a FIFO down here. We call the wait FIFO. The next FIFO over here, and we have the Jack thread. This is created by Jack for the client. And it runs the event loop, which I'll talk about in just a minute. We also have two sockets over here, which are used to handle different kinds of communication with Jack. This is a client-server model, remember. We have JackD and we have the clients. The client is allowed to make certain requests to JackD, like add another port. We'll talk about those in a minute. Or will we? Maybe we won't. It needs to make requests like that. It needs to make requests to shut me down. I'm finished or whatever. In here, we have requests that, or not requests, what we call events that come from the server to the client. And they're not the process events. They're other things like there was an X run, or I'm disconnecting you, or you've just been connected to somebody else. These come into a socket, and the Jack thread handles them down here. There may be, well, there nearly always will be other threads running in this external client, like a GUI thread, or maybe some other thread that does who knows what. We don't really care very much. Oh, I knew this wouldn't fit on the screen. I tell you, it works so nicely at home. I did all these as PNGs originally and then converted them to the web. This slide was called User Space Cooperative Scheduling. Which, if I was to ever write a computer science paper on Jack, is what it would be called. Because that's essentially what we're doing here. So this is a way to look at what's happening from things from a client-centric perspective. We have JackD down the bottom down here. If I wave this around, you'll notice it. And it writes a single byte into this FIFO, which wakes up client N because it's sleeping in pole on this FIFO. It calls its process function, and it writes a single byte to the next FIFO and goes back to sleep. The write to this FIFO wakes up client N plus 1, which does exactly the same thing, which then writes to the FIFO, which wakes up JackD, which, if it would shift to the right, is asleep in pole on that FIFO. So what we have, what we're trying to do here is to have JackD schedule client N. Client N schedules client N plus 1, which then schedules JackD. In a completely functional system, this would happen in a completely deterministic way. Unfortunately, completely functional systems are hard to find. Just a slightly closer look at the event loop that the client's running. All we're really doing is just running in an endless loop. We check we're still connected. and then we go to sleep and wait for an event. An event can either be the FIFO gets written to wake us up to call process, or there's an X run, or we've been connected to something, or whatever. We're awake now, so we mark that we're awake. This is important for the server to have some idea of what the hell we're doing. Then we check on the type of event. If it's process, we mark that we've started running process. If we have a process callback, which we'll talk about more in a minute, we execute it. We mark the end time, and then we start the next client, which basically just means writing to the FIFO. And there are some other events like the X run that could be handled too. And that's it. And there's a few more cases in that switch statement, but there isn't really very much more to it than that. So, client responsibilities. What does a client of Jack do? Well, it has at least one thread that is created and managed for it by Jack. And in the descriptions that we have on the mailing list, we often call that the audio thread. That thread executes callbacks that are registered by the client saying, when a certain condition happens, this is the code I want you to run. When there's audio data to be processed and or generated, run the process callback. If we've had an underrun or an overrun, call the X1 callback. If the sample rate changes, call the sample rate callback. This thread, for the most part, particularly in the process function, must be real-time safe. And by real-time safe, you see the definition that long-time mailing list members will recognize me typing in at least once a week, although I normally do it without a spelling error. The number of cycles that are used to process n frames of audio must be A times n frames plus B, where A and B are constant. That is to say, we don't care, well, we do care, we don't really care what A and B are, but they must be constant. So you can take a long time to process them, but you must always take a long time. There must also be no blocking calls in there. No malloc, no sleep, no read, write, open, close, no pthread condition wait, no pthread mutex lock. The client can have other threads as well that do whatever it needs them to do. MIDI.io, GUI, sending email to your mom, who cares? But no audio I.O., you do not block the Jack thread. And it's probably a good idea to have a shutdown callback registered, because if the server decides to kick you off because it is decided that you're misbehaving and not obeying the rules, your program would probably like to know about it. If it doesn't know about it, it'll just sit there doing nothing, not understanding what's happened. Jack as an audio API. Now, providing a new API for writing audio software was not really ever the goal of Jack, but enforcing a new programming model was. And I think that Jack provides many benefits as an API for writing audio software because it's such a high level of abstraction. There's no hardware configuration, there's no software configuration, there's no format negotiation, all the samples are in the same format, there's no arguing about whether it's 16-bit or 8-bit or which sample rate, there's no arguing about the sample rate, that gets just handed to you. And there's no main loop, because the Jack library handles that for you. On the other hand, it does have to be said that it also means that you're now dealing with multi-threaded programming and lock-free multi-threaded programming. You have a client-server system, which is hard to make truly robust. And you've also got what we generally call a pull model, where now the application is having data sucked out of it by the server. And for certain kinds of programs, this is a harder model. It's not impossible, but there are some kinds of things that are a little harder. And in particular, porting software that was written on the push model to the pull model can be really difficult. There's a program that I worked on early on with Jack called Rhythm Lab, which is a really nice polyrhythmic rhythm generator thing. And it was had everything so tightly tied into the idea that it could read and write whenever it wanted to, that actually changing it to have this model, just it involved a lot of math and a lot of bug hunting and a lot of complete re-architecting of the whole program to the point where I gave up and rewrote it from scratch. So it does have to be acknowledged that there are some problems with this for certain kinds of programs and for porting. So let's talk about a very simple example for those of you that haven't seen Jack in action. This is just a simple example that does nothing more than copy an audio signal from an input to an output. It doesn't do anything else. And it doesn't fit on the screen either. Is there a text size thing in this? Yeah, let's just try to go. Goodbye, example. I can't read you. Well, it'll do. Is that still vaguely legible? Yeah, okay. So what we have here, the very first function we're looking at up here is the process callback that this client is going to register. And all it does, this is what it's going to sit there doing in real time while it's running. It's going to get a buffer associated with two ports, a port being a place that audio data is handled. It's going to get the buffer associated with each port, and once it's got them, it's going to copy data from the import to the output, and then it's done. And it doesn't have to do anything else. In order to get running, we have to start up, check the arguments. We register as a client by calling Jack client new. We set the process callback right here by passing in our process function. We don't have an argument. That's the zero is like a null, but I program in C++ too much. Then we register two ports, an input, a port called input and a port called output. And then we tell the Jack server that we're ready to go. At this point, that process callback that we registered will be called on a periodic basis. We now connect the ports. We can't do that before this because Jack won't allow you to connect ports if you're not running. Otherwise, it means that you are now connected to some other client which is expecting to receive data from you, but you're not running. So it won't receive anything useful. It's an implementation detail that could be changed, but every time I think about it, I think this is correct. So the way we do this is we don't want to hard code in, as we used to do, connect to the ALSA PCM first playback port. Instead, we say, go get all the ports that are physical, correspond to physical connectors, and they're for output. We get back a list of them, and we connect to the first one, which is probably going to correspond to the first channel of your audio interface. We do the same thing for the input port. We want physical ports that are input, and we connect our output port to the first of those. And then we go to sleep for 10 seconds because it's just a toy, and we close the client, and we're all done. So if you actually start this up, which I'm not going to do right now, and you had a signal coming in on the first channel, you'll hear it for 10 seconds on the output channel, and then it's gone. Jack has been a lot more successful than I thought it would be in a much shorter time. Somewhat contrary to my expectations, we've already got, you know, many of the flagship applications for Linux audio that are all doing Jack already. When I compiled this list, when I copied it from the website, I looked at this and thought, I've never heard of that application. There were actually several in here that I'd never even heard of and didn't know they were using Jack at all. I hadn't heard anything about JMAX using Jack. I had never even heard of Hydrogen, and I hadn't heard of Octavian either. So there are literally new applications being added every day, and even I don't know about them. So there's a lot of apps using it already, and they can all talk to each other, and they can all share and exchange data. So how would we improve Jack if we could try to improve it? There's a set of changes that we could make to the kernel, if we only could. One of them is deterministic scheduling. There is some evidence, at least in the 2.4 series, that even real-time scheduled processes, and I'll talk more about what that means tomorrow for people that aren't familiar with it, even real-time scheduled processes don't always get run when they're supposed to be run. People who know about this stuff claim that, yes, that did exist, and that particular problem doesn't exist in 2.5, but other problems like it probably do. So we lose the de-evil that we only knew for a moment for the de-evils that we don't know at all. It would be really nice if kernels came with capabilities turned on by default. one of the problems with running Jack reliably is that we tend to need root privileges or certain capabilities in order to function well, and capabilities are much safer than root access and much more convenient, but the kernels don't come with them by default. And so you have to go to Karma, which I don't know how to say, and various other places in order to actually get kernels that had them turned on. And it, you know, this is really annoying. It's just inconvenient for users to be told you have to run as root, or you have to install a new kernel, you have to recompile your own kernel, with patch this first. It's just not a very good arrangement. As fast as FIFOs are as a method of connecting the clients together and to JACD, they could be faster. They still go through the file system. It means you're still potentially going through various kernel locks in order to use them. And they still involve a bunch of stuff that we really don't care about. We only write a single byte, but we don't need to write anything. All we really are trying to do is to say, wake up, which is why I thought signals would be good, but it turns out signals have a lot of utter overhead. So I haven't really looked into these so-called fast user space mutexes or futexes that 2.5 has. They might be useful. There's also something that was implemented by Sun, actually, and then somebody ported it to Linux called DAWS, which I guess is meant to contrast with pipes rather than windows, but they are also meant to be a very fast user space IPC mechanism. The last thing that would be really nice is if we could reduce interrupt blocking. There are still a number of places in the kernel where interrupts just get blocked for a while. And when this happens, our audio interface, it says, help, I need data, or I have data for you. But the CPU doesn't do anything for a while. Eventually it does, but it doesn't do anything for a while. And by the time we get around to it, although the delay may have been very small when you talk to most Linux programmers about it, it may have chewed up 25% of our total processing time that we have available. You know, Andrew Morton turns around and says, you know, we're down to 500 microseconds, worst case delay. 500 microseconds is nearly half the total time that we have for our lowest latency settings, which means that we're effectively throwing away half the possible processing that we could maximally do on a given processor. It's not good. On the other hand, it's also a very hard problem to solve. We can make some changes in Jack. It would be really great if it handled other data types. MIDI would be an obvious candidate, which then dovetails very much into discussions about a user space ALSA sequencer, because they would essentially do exactly the same thing. Dynamically increase the number of ports. I haven't heard of this actually being a problem so far, but hypothetically it would be nice to not be stuck with a fixed number of ports at the beginning. And it would be good to fix the remaining buglets so that it actually works. It'd be nice to port it. Stefan Letts at Graham has already got a somewhat working port running on Mac OS X. And much to my surprise, it actually provides something that Apple do not provide themselves, which is inter-app communication. I was under the impression that Core Audio provided that. Apparently it does not. I don't know of anybody who stepped up to do a Windows port. I guess you'd base it on ASIO, but I don't know how else you would do it. The last observation here is that we could also change the GUI toolkits so that they were interoperable. And if you did this, in some senses, Jack would just go away. There wouldn't really be a lot of reason for it. We could just use regular shared object plugin APIs, write things using whatever toolkit we wanted to, have IPC going on between a GUI and the DSP part, and we're all set, and we don't need the special system. We lose the benefits of isolating the host from the clients. So it's a little bit there's room for disagreement as to whether that will be a good thing. But if, in fact, the GUI toolkits do one day get their act together to the point where they can exist in the same process, it will be questionable if you were writing a new application whether it's better to write it as an external client of Jack or as an internal client. And if you write it as an internal client, it could be an internal client of anything. It could probably be a LadSpar plugin with its own GUI, for example. So I suppose I guess I want to say I hope that the GUI toolkits don't get their act together. But I'm not really sure I believe that, because it's a real nightmare. I think it's one of the I'm not sure I want to use the word shameful, because I think that's too strong of a term, but it's one of the most annoying features of writing audio application software for Linux, from my perspective, that we cannot integrate good applications written in different toolkits. And finally, some acknowledgements. The designer, Jack, goes back, as I said, to the early, middle of 2001, when several people were very active in contributing to its design, and many other people threw in random ideas. We then got around to a lot of implementation, in which many people have helped. And there's a number of people, Andy and Antti and Tabin, who are all working now on maintaining the website and doing release engineering. And of course, we wouldn't be anywhere without the wonders of SourceForge, which seem to be rapidly going down the drain. But it has provided an incredibly useful host system for us. And somebody's phone or timer just went off. I think I'm done. It's a very rapid run-through about Jack. I originally thought I was going to talk for longer, but I'd be happy to take questions.
Okay, question here?
One statement and one question. Statement is, when Jacques 6.1 was announced last week, I downloaded, installed it. It took your IP example, IP mm-hmm. client example, converted that to C++, added a thread class, added mm-hmm. X client class, added one slider class. That all took 15 minutes. So in 15 minutes time, I had an internal client running with its own user interface. It's only a toy. I think a system that permits me to do that is just great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Question concerning the same thing. if you can do that with the internal mm-hmm. client interface, do we still need the other one?
Well, my best answer to that is a purely personal one, which is that I do, because I'm not rewriting Arda as an internal client and a separate GUI. At least I'm not doing it anytime soon. I do think, when you look at the examples of JMax and PD and several other programs, the model where you start out and you write the GUI code, the DSP code as a shared object, and control it via some IPC mechanism, it is the best way to do it if you do that right from the beginning. And I think we would all be better off, myself included, if we wrote our applications with that design model in mind right from the beginning. But there are many, really useful applications already that just don't have that design in them. And to convert them over to a design where they're required to separate out those two things, not just logically, which Arda does, for example. I mean, the back end of Arda knows nothing about the user interface in any way. Not just a logical separation, an actual physical, well, not physical, process level separation is a huge amount of work. And I think for that reason alone, the external client thing does continue to be useful. But I think that if the internal client thing can be shown to work, if we can get useful examples like yours, it will be really good to try to encourage people. If you're starting a new project, think about this architecture. And do it this way, because we avoid all the context switches that way. And as I said, I mean, it works for two or three clients. We get great response and behavior. But, you boost it up to wanting, to take examples in the Windows world. You want Halion, FM7, and Absinthe running, and then you want this drum machine in the background. If you're context switching between them all, the external client model is not going to hold up. So
I think one of the reasons why Jack works as it works is because it has the right interfaces. Said in your talk as well, to use it as it should be used, you need to think multi-threading.
Uh-huh.
I think that a lot of the problems we have in audio development are just because we don't do that enough, thinking multi-threading. Do you agree?
I would agree.
Yep.
Yeah.
One more question over here from Jörn.
Yeah, I've got two questions from the guys who are listening to your presentation via our MP3 stream, and they're actually feeding back questions over IRC here. First one is from your co-worker, Tabin Rutkin, and he wants to know what would be
Tabin.
Involved in adding MIDI support to Jack?
I think the best suggestion to this actually probably came from Tabin. No, it didn't come from Tabin. Somebody suggested the right way to do MIDI is to have MIDI port buffers, just the same way as we have audio port buffers, and had them sized to handle the maximum amount of MIDI data that you could possibly have in that audio interval. So if you have 1.3 microseconds, you've got, I can't do any more, what is that? You've got, I don't know, 5-6 MIDI bytes available, and you just have a MIDI port type, and the buffer would be 5 or 6 bytes long for that latency or bigger for other ones, and you just fill it. I think doing it that way, just adding MIDI ports like that is probably, you know, a half day to a day's worth of work. The problem is I don't think that by itself is enough. I think that when you look at what the ALSA sequence is doing and you start thinking about what would make MIDI exchange really useful in Jack, you start to realize you really want everything that the sequencer does. And so adding that is, I don't know, I have no clue. There are times when I keep feeling like going in and saying, I'm just going to add MIDI today. Because I just type it in, it'll be in there, and then we can start using it. And then I realize, you know what, that isn't it. Just having MIDI data is not the end of the story there. And also there is this question of whether that's the right way to represent it. I mean, most people who do MIDI want to deliver individual bytes representing a note on or a control message, and this method says you have this buffer to write bytes into in various places. It's a different model. So in short, we could probably have MIDI exchange going on very quickly, but I don't think it would actually address what we really want for MIDI. Sorry, Tabin.
Okay, thanks so far. One more question from Martin Sipkima. He asks, they are chatting so happily away that they scrolled off the question already. Hang on a second.
It's so rude.
Yeah. Here it comes. Martin asks, is not using pthread mutex log function at ALI in the real-time Jack thread a structural requirement, or just because the Linux implementation does not provide the needed guarantees?
Well, Martin, if you're listening, you know that you and I have talked about this online quite a bit. I do think that priority inversion in the kernel would help a lot with this. It would make it safer to call pthread mutex lock if the kernel supported priority inversion. For those who don't know what this means, imagine you have one thread that's running and it takes a lock and is doing something while it holds the lock, and another higher priority thread comes along and wants the lock. You basically get deadlock. Well, you can't get deadlock. Basically, the wrong thing happens unless the lower priority thread inherits the priority of the one that wants the lock for a while until it releases the lock. It goes to sleep, and then the high priority thread gets the lock. All the priority inversion does, however, is it reduces the worst case. It does not stop the fact that the high priority thread still goes to sleep. It has to go to sleep while the low priority thread runs at elevated priority. So it's better. You certainly can use mutexes with, you know, less likelihood of it causing dropouts, but you still have a situation where one of the threads goes to sleep that you don't really want to go to sleep. And in that sense, I don't think it's really enough to add priority inversion. And so I think that you still have to have systems where the main audio thread in Jack does not ever block. It is hard to accomplish that, but I think it's a necessary thing in general.
Okay, so one more question from the audience, if there is any. Otherwise, I think you have one more from the net, Jörn. Okay.
Yeah, one last question from Dustin Barlow. And... He wants to know, is Jack the appropriate place to support the equivalent of VST System Link?
I was thinking about that a little bit earlier on when somebody asked Takashi about network connectivity and ALSA, and he was saying about keeping things in sync with the sequencer and so forth. Something like VST System Link or VST Link, whatever it's called, does seem like a really nice and, in hindsight, very obvious way of providing sync between different computers. And you could certainly do it at the jack level, but on the other hand, if you look at the implementation of VST Link, jack doesn't really have to know anything about it. VST System Link, for those that don't know, basically steals one bit of one audio channel and writes something roughly equivalent to ADAT sync sample code to it. And so you could easily have a master transport client writing one bit of one of its audio channels with a synchronization signal and everything else connected to that. And jack itself wouldn't actually know anything about that. It would just be happening sort of under the hood because there'd be this extra bit, or not extra bit, this stolen bit being transferred through it. I do think something like VST System Link is a very nice model. It really gets rid of a lot of the problems with other proposals for synchronizing, you know, different systems. I don't know what Steinberg is going to do about making their particular design, you know, licensable or open source or anything, but I think that it wouldn't be too hard to just implement something based on the information in their press releases. And it might be really useful to do.
Okay, so I think at this point we'll stop this. Any further discussions, please take them outside. Thank you very much, Dave. Paul, sorry. Okay, we've a slight delay now, so I just take the liberty of postponing the next talk by 10 minutes. So not right now, but in 10 minutes we'll hear Frank van de Poel with a synchronization of sequence applications. See you then.